Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to Deep Thoughts on this recently rained its ass off day. I'm taking a risk here, pulling out all the equipment, hoping that it doesn't begin again. But it looks like there's some blue skies coming up here. So today, as you can tell, we're going to talk about Morgellons disease. And this is one of those subjects that I think is interesting, but it's certainly not an episode I really want to do. And the reason why I get the sort of negative vibe from the entire subject matter is that if this stuff is real, it's sort of depressing, if not very depressing, right? And we have to be very, very careful. My disclaimer on this episode is be extremely careful listening to this information. I'll try to dot the episode with reminders of this, but it's important that we don't psychosomatically catch this, that we don't look at things that are different than what this condition might really be and accuse it of being this condition, because we could get ourselves in some serious trouble attracting the wrong energy to our lives. We know that the government has written papers as recent as 2008 talking about creating a massive disinformation campaign with really one goal in mind: keep everyone distracted. You know, the people that rule the world have two choices, really. Keep us wealthy enough that we're distracted while they do all these crazy things to the world, or they can keep us poor and keep us distracted by fighting each other and being divided. It would appear that the latter formula is what's currently been their strategy up to this point. So this whole distrust of government, it could be building up to a crescendo of nothing more than trust for corporations or trust for some entity that we haven't defined yet, or we haven't had it defined to us yet, right? So we have to be very careful of what we believe and where we think we get our evidence. But the Morgellons thing is on one level scientifically pretty straightforward. It's a little bit miraculous. And the things that are miraculous, oddly, are very observable and have been observed by many. But even though I might give you a lot of credibility in one area, I have to tell you, I have no experience with Morgellons disease personally. The reason why I'm getting into this is I had an acquaintance slash friend of mine who recently texted me and said, I think I've got it, Morgellons disease. And then a lot of you have come up recently and said, please do an episode on Morgellons. We were talking about Morgellons. So I think that there's a definite internet trend going on, and this is why we're all talking about it, because I don't think that trends on the internet happen as willy-nilly as we might be led to believe. Meaning, this bunny rabbit does this funny thing and it catches on, it goes on Jimmy Kimmel's show, and then there's 20 million views. It happens. But that's sort of a hands-down positive thing, whereas Morgellons is not something anyone would wish on any world ever, right? And just as a footnote, because this came up recently with some friends of mine, the idea that anyone wants to believe a conspiracy theory is sort of insane, because I don't know too many happy conspiracy theories. You know, maybe Roswell. But who wants to believe we faked a mission to the moon? Who wants to believe any of the false flags are there, that, you know, pharmaceutical companies aren't out to really heal man, you know, et cetera, down the line. So Morgellons is one of these things that, if someone accuses you of, oh my God, you want to believe in all these, you want to believe in all these conspiracy theories, there's no way in hell anybody wants to really believe in Morgellons disease. Now, having said that, we all know that there's people that are hypochondriacs for one reason or another. Some people, there's Munchausen by proxy, where a parent is essentially constantly trying to get their child diagnosed with something so that the parent gets all this attention, but they remain healthy. And then there's just individuals that try to gain attention by always being sick. So no matter what you're dealing with, those three categories of people are going to be surrounding this issue. Morgellons disease. Morgellons disease got its name because a wife of a gentleman who died of what she believes to be Morgellons disease, it was blamed on ALS. His body was covered pretty much from head to toe with a bad red rash. Not every single square inch of his body, but most of it from the photographs I've seen. But to define Morgellons disease, you have, the way that it is actually discovered is that people have cystic sores. They have lesions, which are places where your skin is broken apart and the inside of your muscle tissue is available to see. And when looking down inside these cavernous sort of craters in your body, this is one way you can see it, they see fibers, almost like carpet fibers, and they have all kinds of different colors, and they move, and sometimes they've been filmed crawling out of these lesions. For those without lesions and those with lesions, they feel like they can feel this stuff crawling underneath their skin, looking for and out. Okay. Now again, I'm going to dot it right here. For those of you who've ever felt a tickle on your flesh, it does not mean you have Morgellons disease necessarily. It simply means that you have a circulatory problem at that point. You could have bumped your arm and not realized it. Your capillaries start, you could bust several capillaries in a little bump on something. And the reason why you have an itch is that your body's saying, I need you to scratch this right here to give it some circulation, blood circulation. Back to Morgellons. Some physicians who don't have any experience looking at people with these lesions have surmised, without looking at the patients, almost cowardously, that what they are doing is there's people that just pick themselves, right? You'll find people with bad skin pick themselves, right? And it's sort of a chicken and egg thing. What came first? The itch, the paranoia, the tick that makes people scratch on themselves. But once you get something started, well, then you can blame the, oh, well, it was there, and I scratched it because it was there. And then, you know, you don't know where it started. But there's individuals that scratch themselves, pick on things, little bumps and moles, and they create lesion-looking things. They dug it out with their fingernails, but their idea is that it came naturally. And once you have part of the skin open, you have a situation where your fibers from your shirt, from your clothing, from carpet can get into those open sores, and then when you look at the open sore you see a fiber, except that there's one distinct difference with Morgellons and these fibers, and that is that the fibers actually have a crystalline life to themselves. They move. I've seen it on cameras. So those are the two primary diagnostic conditions that the patient will report to the doctor if they have the true Morgellons disease, if indeed this stuff exists, which I think when you start looking it up on YouTube, you're going to start finding that there's a tremendous amount of evidence as a result of, was it microscopy? When you look at cellular life, the study of cellular life from a microscopic standpoint, there's electron microscope analysis, and they've really started digging in deep. But let me give you my background with my research in it. I am not exactly positive when I did a deep dive on this. It was between 5 and 10 years ago when the information was a little bit more sparse. It ended up, I believe, with an episode on Oprah where she had some people come on and a physician researched them. And obviously they had the physician that said it was all crazy, you're all nuts. And then a physician sat in the front row and said, I think this is real, but I don't know what it is. So because it went on Oprah, you think, well, geez, that's controlled media for sure, right? Nothing's going to slip out of an Oprah show and surprise the world. So in terms of a PSYOP, that might be a sign of a PSYOP. Who knows? But I think there's enough people physically suffering that we have to take this seriously for a little while. And supposedly the government's getting involved at various levels. But what I didn't realize was this. When I bumped into this whole thing, I'm not even sure where I bumped into it initially, you know, like you never do, right? We have a condition that's got these weird fibers like little wormy fibers crawling out of lesions out of people's bodies, and you can see them swimming underneath the epidermis in certain photographs and movies people take. But I didn't realize it, but there was a previous situation that was related to it that I had found, again, probably around 2007, 2008, which was related to the chemtrail phenomenon. And for those of you that are sort of in denial about chemtrails, you have to understand that several agencies have talked about aerosol programs being completely instantiated, including NASA talking about it. The geoengineers of the world have discussed every single thing that we see in a chemtrail plane, but their only caveat is that we haven't turned it on, is what they say, quote unquote. So they've completely described it. They deny it's ever been turned on because, again, these things are compartmentalized. We have individuals in the military who have facilitated the replenishing of the planes with aluminum oxide, barium oxide, and various other chemicals. And then after 9 years of helping them do this without real knowledge of what they were doing, finally did their math and said, I'm going to blow the whistle on this thing. We have interviewed both my old show that doesn't exist anymore, MKUltra Radio. My co-host and I have interviewed fighter pilots, commercial pilots, and private pilots about chemtrails. And there's, you know, conclusive opinion. Two of them told us, and again, they don't know each other, but two of the pilots told us it's not us. And another pilot told us a bunch of different stories about having seen them, about how the planes don't show up on radar, how, in case one of my close friends, he told me that he was flying a G5 back from South America. He said that a chemtrail plane nearly bumped into him at night, and he had to call down to air control and say, look, I got this plane off to my right. It's about the size of a 737. And it's dumping out all these chemicals, and it's pretty much flying black on radar. What do we do? No call back from ground control. The plane zooms up several hundred nautical miles. You can still see it, but then air traffic control comes back and says, he's out of your way now. No response, which is very, you know, outside of protocol. I believe air traffic control follows protocol. And once the plane was in front of him, he said that they had to change altitude because they were flying into the chemtrail, the actual dust, which is very bad for turbines. So these things are very real. And the very first research that I ever saw about chemtrails was the group out of Santa Fe. And I've talked about it in my chemtrail episode in season one. And at first I felt silly talking about this stuff because it's so far out there that you sort of go, oh, gosh, this is sort of the extreme, and but without doing research personally in this stuff, you know, you should be cautious and feel a little weird and maybe even a tad embarrassed to talk about things that you haven't confirmed yourself to other people. You know, I'm in a weird position of trying to create episodes, and I want to keep the integrity of the episodes as high as possible, and give you the ability to see what I've seen and make up your own mind, right? Everything I'm going to talk about on this particular episode, other than chemtrails in the sky that I've taken several pictures of, and I mean super-duper pictures of planes doing this, including them flying north from San Diego, dumping a trail, and then coming back 45 minutes later while a new one's going north doing a new trail, which is supposed to be the condition of the atmosphere, right? Creating ice crystals. His buddy with the same tail fin photograph coming the other way without his without any chemtrails. So he's flying the same exact altitude, just a further out of sea, and he doesn't have any trail at all coming out of his engine. Neither do any of the commercial planes on the same day. Once you start taking pictures of chemtrails and looking up, you'll see the intelligent design of their construction. But back to Santa Fe. So the very first people that discovered chemtrails that I'm aware of was in the late 90s, about 97. Santa Fe, New Mexico is a place in America where millionaires go to retire. And there are also some folks that just migrate there. So there were two gentlemen that took action after a bunch of artists kept going out to the desert to paint. And they realized that these planes were painting grids over the sky, and that all the ambient light was disappearing, and so, you know, the richness of color was missing. And so they complained to the, because they thought it was Air Force maneuvers, and so they complained to the Air Force. The Air Force says, we're not doing anything. And they said, well, you know, it's, then you need to look at the air traffic control over this area because someone's doing something. Well, all the way up to the point where a millionaire, and I make this distinction because you need to know the difference in personalities, one of their local residents flew his private jet up there and scooped the stuff out of the sky, flew right through it. Then he gave the part of it to a guy that begged for a portion of it, who was sort of a hippie guy, who literally lived in a van down by the river sort of thing, but he was, you could tell he was fairly well off. He had purchased a bunch of telescopes, or excuse me, microscopes, and chain-linked all of the lenses together to get up to about a 10,000 power microscope, which is pretty significant for personal ownership. He started seeing some strange things. He reported back to the guy that grabbed it, and they both said it's probably a good idea that they use their connections to give it to someone with an electron microscope. Now, electron microscopes, what you have to understand is that you cannot use one without telling the government slash shadow government what you're looking for, because you might start looking in an area that, I guess, could cause them problems, I guess. I mean, how much bullshit is that? I mean, if you bought a really powerful telescope, but you had to tell the government every time you're looking to space, wouldn't you think there's something a little strange there? But apparently that's how electron microscopes are managed. But the gentleman started looking at submicron fibers that were falling out of the sky. They look like carpet fibers. Sort of that petroleum-looking strand that you would see if you zoomed up on perhaps white carpet or whatever, right? But the weird thing was that inside these fibers, at a particular interval of notching, inside the fiber, which are now called filaments, like a hollow filament, you know, light bulbs are called filaments because they're hollow with the stuff inside. They found little red blood cells growing inside these fibers. Now, here's the weird thing. Red blood cells do not grow outside of the human body, and they don't grow, well, I mean, for humans, they don't grow outside of our bone marrow contribution. So someone has figured out how to create human red blood cells inside artificial filaments. Because what happened was the red blood cells inside these fibers were designated as desiccated. Desiccated is a fancy word for saying dehydrated, because there was no, you know, water in the filament. It's sort of like this blister-packed tube of red blood cells. And if you look at the scans that you can find online, I think morgellonsexposed.org is something that you can look at. But these filaments have, in a certain micron interval, nano interval, a cell, and then a cell, and then a cell, and then a cell. So this guy, who doesn't really know what he's been given, because he didn't say, hey, these are chemtrail fibers that fell out of the sky, because they wanted his unbiased opinion about it, he was able to scan the composition of the cell itself. And he said, you know what's weird about this? He goes, these red blood cells are strange in one characteristically unique way. He said, they are perfect. Just like a cubic zirconian diamond is actually a perfect diamond, these red blood cells are manufactured, suggesting that man-made intervention made this stuff. And so he puts it in a test tube overnight, this third guy, and reconstitutes the dehydrated red blood cells. And I guess he put it in something that burned off the filament, melted off the filament, the actual outer fiber. And they shot video, and there's, you know, I don't know where this video is anymore. I watched this over 10 years ago for sure. But they showed the video of the test tube having grown the red blood cells. And I'm going to put a link in the bottom of this video of the video that I watched recently, which I thought was probably the best summation of everything going on. It's by a woman named Dr. Smallstorm. She goes up to a podium and gives a really intense easy to watch presentation. And full disclosure, I'm going to be adding what I learned about Morgellons before I watched her video. And then I'm going to give some distinctions that she has. So there's definitely plagiarizing or paraphrasing of her research. So please give her some eyeballs as well. She deserves it. So this guy comes back to the laboratory and notices, again, red blood cells have grown overnight inside of a test tube, which medically is supposed to be scientifically impossible. It'd be very encouraging if this actually worked and we could just grow blood. I mean, imagine, blood banks would simply go away. But of course, what's the impact of doing such a thing, right? I'm not suggesting we all become transhumans right away. So I watched that research. The hippie guy gave the presentation that I saw. He's a very well articulated guy. He was unwilling to conclude anything. He said, look, I have my opinions and we're continuing research in this area, these three gentlemen working together. And he said, but I'm unwilling to tell you what I think these are at this stage, because, you know, it's really not important that he get an opinion from the public at that point. He just simply wanted to know for himself what the hell he was dealing with, right? But so I've got this fiber technology, you know, falling out of the sky from chemtrails, but there was no Morgellons disease as a result of the presentation. Well, the first thing you want to ask yourself is, why would fibers be dropping out of the sky in the first place? What would be the point of manufacturing them, putting them in the sky, and dropping them out? Now, I want you to also focus on the notion that when we talk about chemtrails, the two chemicals that come up all the time is barium oxide and aluminum oxide. And Dr. Russell Blaylock has done the research on the aluminum oxide and barium oxide and how it penetrates the blood-brain barrier through the nasal canal and how it causes neural problems like dementia and Alzheimer's. So he's a brilliant gentleman who's done a lot of research in that area. You should look him up. Russell Blaylock. Brilliant guy. His videos are very entertaining to watch. He's a very soft-spoken southerner, but he's so amazingly brilliant that you'll love it. He's also gone around the world trying to keep water from being fluoridated because he knows the neural impact to the brain. But imagine that focus on these oxides while the real threat is actually the strands. And I want to also note that it could be that what comes out of one plane is different than what comes out of another plane. It could be that there really is a particular atmospheric phenomenon over one particular area of the Earth. It's creating longer crystalline trails behind a plane. And it's supposed to be a minute and a half is the longest that's ever been recorded in the South Pole from a plane. But who knows, right? My buddy who flew the private jets for a living, he said that, you know, you have to take courses in aviation college about chemtrails, or sorry, about contrails, excuse me. And so when he started looking at chemtrails, and he said, you know, he took over a year and a half of training about contrails in one way or the other, and he said that these things simply don't behave like the contrail training that we have. And when he pointed at him several times with other pilots, being a co-pilot of a commercial airline, his pilot on two different occasions said, we don't talk about those. So, and my buddy has no link to any conspiracy whatsoever and wasn't really interested in the conversation that we were having. He wasn't, you know, evasive or anything, but he was like, yeah, you know, he was drinking a beer at this restaurant we go to. And he wasn't chastising me at all for asking him the questions, but it was just, he just didn't have any interest in it. So I like those kind of people because it seems like their answers are a lot more genuine and rooted in truth, right? So in comes Morgellons disease. I believe the way that the story goes, and if you look up Morgellons ABC, you'll see the woman interviewed who gave it its name, and her name escapes me at the moment, but she has a daughter and at least two sons. The father's passed on, and she went and looked up a disease from the 1700s where it talked about fibers. And so she's probably wrong in connecting Morgellon with the Morgellon disease found in the 1700s with what's happening today, because what's happening today is seems to be, according to Dr. Smallstorm, 100% linked to nanotechnology. And I'll get into that in just a second here. but she gave it the name online. And then as people started to amass experience with this weird fibrous thing, which happened to, again, coincide with the introduction of chemtrails, right? So chemtrails supposedly, you know, they've been off and on. And, you know, we're not exactly sure when it started, because it seems to be there's a couple movies here and there with them in there. The Three Amigos, if you roll the credits to Three Amigos at the beginning, they are in the desert riding on their horses. And so to see trails in the sky isn't really necessarily a chemtrail thing, but it could be the test runs. But because there's a lot of afterburner exercises and a fighter pilot, dogfight training up in the atmosphere of the deserts, it could just simply be regular maneuvers, but it looks like there's one there. I'll give you one other one. The scene in the Muppet movie. Go watch the original 1979 Muppet movie. Towards the beginning, there's a scene where they bump into Big Bird. It's Fozzie Bear and Kermit the Frog bumping into Big Bird walking down the side of the highway, which is a funny joke because Big Bird's part of Sesame Street. And the Muppets are made by the same guy, Jim Henson, at the time, who had his different franchise. But in the background, there's a trail going from horizon to off camera, which is massive. And you'll find little anomalies here and there over the years, right? So I'm going to tell you right now, before I go any further, I would love for these things to be natural, to be explained in a consistent way that can correlates with photography, that correlates with the fact that jets are sharing airspace that violates FAA rule, to see the altitude of these things being sprayed outside of military altitudes, which is essentially 20,000 feet to the ground, which is restricted for military airspace. You know, there's the little pilots that fly the little Cessnas around, and there's a little bit of an altitude there to do, you know, skydiving and that kind of stuff. But it's definitely an area up there that is lower to the ground, and that's where we see these things sprayed, right? But so chemtrails come online as a result of the Santa Fe folks doing their research. They find the fibers. They research it all before the year 2000. And this woman coins the phrase Morgellons as her husband died of this stuff. And now it would appear, I believe I have the right year on her, so I apologize if I've got her data back too soon or too late, you know, further in the 90s, but I think she was a late 90s event. She's got it now. Her little boy has it. Her little boy has a sore on his side of his mouth that hasn't healed. And the weird thing was ABC paid to have the family taken to a doctor who had no experience with Morgellons at all. And they said, okay, here's the thing. This woman thinks she's got this thing called Morgellons. And she says that all the lesions in their bodies have fibers in them. And sure enough, this woman was kind of smiling as they filmed this clinic. It's like a little, you know, little walk-in clinic. And she takes a little shot glass, magnifying glass thing that you can get for stamps and that kind of stuff. And she puts it right on the kid's mouth. And on video, you watch her kind of recoil at the notion that she saw a black fiber embedded in this kid's face. And again, the way the doctors who are too chicken shit to look into this explain it away is that someone has scratched themselves, then they get their shirt on themselves, or they roll around the carpet, they're exposed to fibers, and the fibers get embedded by someone scratching through their clothing, right? So when you scratch through your clothing, you're pressing your clothing into the lesion, and that's how they get fibers into the lesion. Now, I personally have seen, I guess, you know, 8 to 10 years ago, videos of these fibers, you know, crawling out of people's lesions. And there's so many videos of this happening that, you know, I doubt everyone has a visual effects team to help them out, right? So fast forward to today. Fast forward to the research of two women, Dr. Smallstorm, I don't know her first name, and a woman named Jan Smith, which may or may not be her real last name, right? Jan Smith is an individual that has Morgellons disease and is having, she's connected to a lot of research institutions, and she is having, I would say, nano systems pulled out of her body routinely and then biopsied through electron microscopes, and they are finding that she is utterly a human foundry of this stuff, that whatever these little systems are supposed to be doing, they are doing at an exponential rate in her body, which is terrifying, right? So what do they find? Well, the way that Dr. Smallstorm talks about this, she actually comes at this in a really beautiful way. She comes at it from two different classifications of what they're finding inside human bodies. One, she talks about the three kingdoms of life that are out there when it comes to this sort of cellular tissue. One of them is bacteria, which we're all familiar with. The other one is eukarya, which is what we are as human beings. We're susceptible to all kinds of stuff. And eukarya is also fungi, slime fungus, all that kind of stuff. And then there's archaea, which is that classification of life that is, they find bacteria living in sulfuric acid clouds. It seems to be impermeable to heat, pressure, acids, what have you. And it's this amazing form of life that is just invincible. That's a third classification. The fibers that they're finding physically appear to look like bacteria because they're engineered entities, but that has the characteristics of the archaea, classification in the kingdom of life. Then the second group of classifications that Dr. Smallstorm talks about, which you can watch in her video, and I really recommend you all click over and look through it. Again, try not to go crazy with it. I am going to mention the wine test right after I do this because I want to put some caution out there. Nanosystems that are built for sort of the transhumanism movement of you ingest them in your body and they go through four stages of transformation, follow four stages. One, you have to introduce the subatomic and atomic materials. I shouldn't say subatomic. The nanoatomic materials into the bloodstream, into the saliva, breathing it through your nose, what have you. Those will then manifest into structures. Substructures that in themselves are more like sort of a cogwheel from a watch, but not the watch itself. Then the structures engage in processes where they can connect together according to very regimented rules, sort of like the DNA double helix. It is a bunch of structures that have an alpha numeric designation, and various nucleic acids can get together and form the last stage, which is called a device. So materials, structures, she goes in a pyramid form, so the bottom layers, materials, then structures, then processes, then devices. And this is sort of the science that the nanotechnology researchers have designated, okay? So in the form of Morgellons, you have a very interesting multi-stage process as far as everything I can tell. And even Smallstorm didn't really get into a diagram of the stages, but it would appear that the ingestion of the structures has to do with ingesting these fibers from the air, which we think are dropped out of chemtrail planes. And it would seem that the proximity of where they are dropped is at an altitude that is in the military restricted zone, which is below commercial airlines, such that it doesn't have a tremendous distance to fall before it hits the population that it's targeted for. But safe to say, if you look straight up and see a chemtrail over your head, that's not going to hit you. It's going to hit someone further east or wherever your wind happens to be blowing predominantly on that day. Again, I'm just passing on information here. So you ingest the structures in these fibers. Your saliva, as designated and tested by the first group in the 90s, should break down the fiber itself, leaving you with the red blood cells to ingest. And then what starts to occur is very interesting. The idea is that you ingest the fibers, and the fibers simply animate and come to life within your body. As far as I can tell from the research submitted to the internet, which could be completely fake disinformation, but again, no one's really putting this together, you know, so this will be sort of a diagram for your mind of how this is being communicated. But the idea is that these fibers release the structures. The processes that take place are that these cells form crystalline structures in the human body. And they are specifically in the shape of a hexagon, a six-sided hexagon. So take a stop sign and knock out to the parallel sides and you have a hexagon. These hexagons then emit from them the strands and fibers that we then see all over the body. In one case, a doctor had found one of these hexagon crystals, I believe submitted by Jan Smith, and in analyzing it, it sprouted a fiber out of its side. So you have this beautiful shape, right? But it sprouts a little worm out of itself within 20 seconds of being analyzed, okay? Which seems to be that the crystal is the device that is spitting out the fibers. And then what I'm not quite clear about is how the fibers interact, but I think what it happens is we're going into an ancestral loop. The crystals then start submitting more fibers into the body, which then create the original fibers that the plane actually dropped out in the first place. So you have the pyramid go in this constant loop that the device is simply creating its base materials to create more devices. So it's a replication pattern. It's really quite brilliant. But now let's look at the fact that, oh, and I should say, plant life is actually manifesting these hexagons as well. There's a woman that had been looking at hay. She was a botanist of some sort, looking at hay, and she had found pink crystals shaped in hexagons, very, very tiny, that were found in our hay. For our animals. So it seems like as long as they have nutrients of some sort, they have the base materials to do what they're going to do, which is to replicate. So what part of that stage is important for the human body when it comes to those that have created these nanomachines? Okay. Well, how do we know that they're nanomachines? How do we know that they are something that man created to either do man harm or good? Well, there is nanotechnology dyes that have been developed to help scientists designate their creations. And the crystals that they are finding, sort of calcium-plated crystals, like plaque almost, they unanimously carry the color designations naturally of these nanotechnology dyes. So as they form, they are these fluorescent rainbow colors. Some of them are blue. Some of them are entirely red. Some of them are pink. Some of them are stacked up almost like a kaleidoscope of Play-Doh, where they have center cores and there's a bunch of different replicated sort of like butterfly shapes or butterfly colors on the back of a butterfly's wings that are embedded in these crystals. I'm going to tell you that if this is truly what is being seen, that the base product that they're trying to create throughout the human body and any body is a ton of these hexagonal crystals. That is the goal. Because there is something called the piezo effect. It's spelled P-I-E-Z-O. And the piezo effect was discovered way, way before any of this stuff came about. But it is the principle by which if you take a crystal, there is an interesting relationship that a crystal has with frequency and voltage. If you apply a frequency of electricity to a crystal, it outputs a voltage. But the cool thing is if you apply a voltage to it, it outputs a frequency. Wow, that's interesting, right? Now, let's rewind to a subject that has come up several times in research, and I mentioned it here on this show. I have an episode on mind control that a bunch of researchers once cellular phone towers were starting to be spread all over the world. Some Australian researchers are probably the most predominant ones, but they came out and said, these antennas that transmit our cell phone calls are actually capable of transmitting the frequency that the brain uses to construct thought. Capable, all right? Very key word there. They are not transmitting phone calls at the exact waves that our brains work, but they are capable of hitting that frequency if adjusted, if simply told to. And there's a lot of papers on this. And I heard about a year ago that France was going to be removing all wireless communication within their schools, forbidding cell phone towers from being close to schools, and that they were all going to go hardwired to reduce on the interference of the ability for a child to concentrate in school. So I hope that's true. I've not seen that story twice, but I definitely read it because I wouldn't never have made it up. And I will say, it's kind of funny. Americans, American companies in general, they will lie to Americans by telling them that Europeans are doing something. But, you know, it's like almost a century-old, if not two-century-old trick. And you'll see this portrayed in fictional stories all the time where they'll say, well, this is what they're doing in Paris, France, you know. And then somebody here in America goes, well, I don't want to be behind Paris, France, so you give me some of that, right? So every time I read stories like that, now that we're in a more global-based communication, I always think of those stories. But anyway, so the body starts creating tons of crystals. The piezo effect happens. Well, let's look at this. The Earth's average peak frequency is 32 hertz. And this is peak. This means that the Earth is usually way below 32 hertz. And it's a frequency emissions from its bowels. Where you get 32 hertz is from electrical storms, which are obviously way more violent than reality. But you have cell phone towers and you have various hotspots that can be created from devices like your routers in your house that range from 3,000 megahertz to 30 billion hertz, which is gigahertz. And this is the world that we live in now. We live in all of this frequency. Our cars that have GPS systems and cellular systems in them for Sirius radio and all that stuff. Tons of frequency being broadcast at us while we drive a car. Your cell phones. Your cell phones have two frequency poles that you have to be aware of. One is the lighter one, which is the actual call itself. And the second one is the power supply in your phone, which creates the antenna poles that you get your call from. So the power supply in your phone is obviously more lethal than the call itself. And that's where the cancer connection is on a phone. It's the power supply when it is... it's pretty much, it's not good for you during the best of circumstances with five bars on your phone. But know that when you have one bar on your phone is exuding a massive pole of electromagnetic energy to try and create an antenna pole around your phone that is interrupted by the cell phone tower. And it could be, so I've had it explained to me, every bar that goes down is an exponential increase in the amount of power that your phone can actually use. So it can be up to 4x use of power. And all of you have experienced this. When you got out of range, your battery goes down quicker. Imagine putting that to your face. You're just eating up your cells. It can boil the mitochondria inside your cell. So if your body is full of crystals, and this piezo thing is actually real, and there's been a tremendous amount of research that has been announced by the intelligence agencies of the world in the area of mind control. Again, they don't tell you exactly how they do it. They just tell you that they've... the last claim I really heard from an agent that I believed was an actual agent was he said that by the mid-90s, they had completed the project. So I don't know if that's, you know, MKUltra, you know, Manchurian candidate shock treatment sort of thing, or if it's actually something like beaming harp antenna radios down on people. But if human beings are full of a bunch of synthesized crystals that is in this ancestral nanosystem loop, then there would be plenty of crystals to translate into the piezo effect to give off frequencies of thought, emotion, biological growth. You know, there, it's no mystery that they want to control the way we think about them. And their biggest agenda on planet Earth is depopulation. And so if you create a cancerous frequency for the human body, then who knows, right? You manifest things in your body that are going to hurt you, sort of thing. And again, I don't want anyone running off going crazy thinking that, you know, one, you have Morgellons disease, and two, you're going to die of it, right? So let's go back to the wine test I promised you guys I'd talk about. So some of you have heard of this, some of you haven't. But they've developed this thing called the wine test, which I'm just going to tell you seems hokey as shit. Okay, and it seems like if you wine test yourself, you're going to have 100% of the people who wine test are going to come up with the positive indicators you have Morgellons disease, which is not a good indicator that it's real. All right? Here's the way it works. You get some red wine, not white wine, got to be red wine because we're looking for the dye properties of red wine. And you take a pretty good mouthful, leave yourself some swishing space, and you swish it inside your mouth, and you spit it out on a, don't spit it, but let it fall out on a white plate. Can't be a plate with a pattern. And what you're supposed to do is look at the wine and say, I'm looking for stringy patterns of supposedly Morgellons strands. And so if you see clumps, if you see, you know, little fibrous things, then you definitely have Morgellons disease. All right. Have any of you ever researched your genealogy test packages you can get in the mail where you have a little cotton swab thing and you swipe it on the inside of your mouth and you put it in an envelope and send it off? The reason why, okay, they like the inside of your mouth is it is the most, I guess, forgiving area of the human body when it comes to giving up cellular tissue. And I'm going to tell you why. There's really two properties that release cells in the mouth a lot different than any other place in your body. One, because it's heavily moisturized, as you know, and there's a lot of cavities inside of our body that are moisturized, but this is the one we have access to the most. The cellular tissue cannot maintain its strong bonds like it does for your epidermis, your skin on the outside, right? So because it's heavily moisturized in there, it's going to give up a lot of cells. It just will. But the second thing is that most of us have rows of teeth above and below. And for any of you who have ever had bit your lip inside, you've bit the side of your mouth, your cheek, you know it sort of swells up. But you'll know that your teeth are like pretty much calcium or an enamel razor blades that are constantly scraping the inside of your mouth. So whether or not you can feel it, whether or not you have an opening lesion due to biting it, you are constantly, through talking, scraping the side of the inside of your mouth. And so to find that there's a string of cells that happen to look like a fiber, it could be that, again, you're squeezing your cells in a horizontal manner when you talk, right? You know, my genetics, as alien as they are, I barely have enough space for my teeth and my tongue in my mouth. And so I grew up growing and really biting my tongue all the time. And it was just tough until I finally settled down. I guess I now razor blade my body in shape inside there. But in terms of finding a bunch of clumpy stuff in wine, you're going to find it. You're probably going to find it 100% of the time. So please don't use this wine test as any indication. Your test would be having a lesion occur without you scratching, looking at fibers come out of a lesion that seem to have their own movement, right? And crystalline structures are the most fundamental structures of life on Earth, right? All the theories of something from nothing, you know, evolution on planet Earth is that, you know, enzymes, amino acids, nucleic acids getting struck by lightning, getting, you know, this piezo effect essentially happening, and then eventually something pops out that turns into a cell, that turns into a multicell, and then we have human life, and well, plant life first, and then animals, and then humans. So this Jan Smith character, as documented by Dr. Smallstorm, she has found structures in her body which are actually patented nanosystem structures for pretty much gene splicing. And she has found microscopic things that mimic normal biological occurrences in reality that have been synthesized using something called GNA. GNA is a synthetic copy of DNA. And the only difference is that it's missing two carbon atoms that DNA actually has. So they're able to actually synthesize together artificial versions of normal biological occurrences in all life using GNA. So it's sort of this dangerous, weird substitute for DNA. And they have found these weird entities inside of her body that mimic this stuff. And it's all photographed, so you can take a look at it on this video I'm going to link below. But there was also another weird occurrence when they started exposing these fibers to, which the fibers are actually susceptible to heat, but the structures, or sorry, the devices they end up creating aren't, right? So the archaea structures are very resistant, and they actually come back to life after being, you know, fried up in a fire dish. But they have found things like nanoarrays. Nanoarrays are, they look like a sort of a kite, those old the Chinese kites that are made of like boxes, right? But there's four boxes. The two outer ones are smaller, the two center ones are thicker, but they're four compartments. And what they are doing almost mechanically is getting two genes to hold hands. And what they do is within a particular gene, they attach a nanoarray and they send it out into the body. And wherever the other gene exists in the body that has another nanoarray attached to it, so you have nanoarray, or you have gene one, gene two, and they both have nanoarrays attached to them, the two nanoarrays can talk to each other. So they have this kind of mezzanine conduit between them. The two genes would never talk to each other natively, but through the nanoarray, they're willing to discuss genetic formation. Now, there's photographs of this from Jan Smith's body. Again, because it would take a tremendous amount of effort to follow the formation of whatever it's trying to do, I don't believe they've actually followed it all the way to the end. But what they have discovered in Jan's body are structures that aren't genes, but are these weird structures, and they are actually communicating through two nanoarrays. And the nanoarray is actually a patented object. It's something created by the nanotechnology industry. So to have this found inside a human body that didn't volunteer for such experimentation is sort of the scary part. Right? So then the question comes back, that always comes back, which is, who would do this and why would they do it? Well, we have to assume, one, that it's actually occurring. When you start studying, I guess Morgellonsexposed.org, I think that's the website. I guess you could look up Dr. Smallstorm and the video I'm going to show you. You have a ton of people researching this now. They've taken the byproduct of these filaments and their red blood cells, and they've put them in petri dishes for 5 to 7 days and then exposed them to electricity, and they watched the piezo effect fill up a petri dish with what looks like a bedding of red blood cells. I mean, it is just absolutely bizarre. But I was actually encouraged to see Dr. Smallstorm take this to a level of, which that name just sounds funny, doesn't it? I always think that, psyop-y individuals are named after funny projects like Snowden, right? He snowed us all over because he didn't really reveal anything of any interest. Julian Assange is a real name, and it seems like he really made an impact on the world, right? So Dr. Smallstorm sounds interesting. But anyway, she seems very dedicated to what she's doing, and she's giving presentations, what have you, as long as the information is real, and she's real. I meant to loop back on when they expose these fibers to heat, that they will actually boil down into, like, there's these transparent fibers, but when they're exposed to heat, they boil down into this kind of ball of gold. And I think they've called it the gold nugget. And it is gold. There's some incredible photographs in the video that showed almost like a gold piece of jewelry. It's very symmetrical. It looks ornate. It looks almost alien in its form. So it's very interesting. Now, there's a transhuman movement going on in the world. It's a multi-pronged piece of science and research. I did a whole episode on it. I could probably do 10 episodes on it, to be honest with you. But she dove off into Kurzweil's research and trying to create what's called the singularity. So there's a guy named Dr. Kurzweil. He writes lots of books. His known specialty is artificial intelligence. They give him the credit of being extremely accurate in his scientific predictions of the future. I can tell you that that's being a genius about predictions in science can merely be the difference of you have 98.9% of the society doesn't know anything about a subject, so the tiny sliver that does know something about science tells the world where they're going scientifically, seems like magic to most people, and then you get this huge credit that you're a genius, right? I could make predictions about virtual reality today, because I know a lot about it, that will be correct in 5 to 10 years, and it will not be something that the society as a whole saw coming. But it won't mean that I'm a genius, it just means I have common sense, and I've been involved. I've seen things work that are being hyped up through press releases saying that the... I've seen things not work that PR statements say do work. And when you boil it all down, you'll say, I don't think this is going to succeed. That's going to succeed. Doesn't mean I'm a genius. It just means I've been involved. That's all, right? So I think Kurzweil has some accolades that are very just in his observations of the world. And I think some are just common sense, right? But he's up there trying to create what he calls a singularity. He's sponsored by Google now. A friend of mine just had dinner with him. Apparently, he doesn't eat food anymore. He takes about 250 pills a day. He believes he's going to live forever, although my friends say he looks like he's deep in his 80s when he's only in his 60s. But Dr. Smallstrom focused on him for a little while because when you're trying to figure out who would do this, if there's a secret agenda anywhere in the world, it's secret. Right? So what are your choices to figure it out? You're going to have to go out and do a lot of observing, a lot of connecting dots. Try not to get obsessive about it, right? But let things really connect naturally. Don't try to create frog DNA to make things connect that don't connect. But in her observations, which I think are fairly straightforward, she's saying, look, there's a nanotechnology research going on right now in the world. It's not there because it doesn't have an agenda and it doesn't have a goal. It's there because it has an agenda and a goal. Otherwise, no one would fund it. There are private industry organizations creating tools, DNA printers, 3D printers to help help the nanosystems exist. I've seen complete schematics on nanosystems that can build, anything atomic. Most of you know that there are 3D printed hearts now, 3D printed organs. They haven't quite, I don't think, put them in human beings yet, but the agenda's there. And the minute it saves your life, you're not going to have any problem with them having done this. But the overwhelming majority of investment in nanotechnology is by respective governments. And that's interesting. So what could be their goal? Of the private industry investors, well, what could be their goal? Creating tools makes complete sense because then you're facilitating the industry and you can sell your printers to the government agencies that have the actual biological end goals when you just have a functional end goal of making the machine. So Dr. Smallstorm, she talks about who are they and what are their goals, right? And her concern is that there are people in this world that believe Kurzweil had said one of his predictions, by 2020, computers will be smarter than man. That's a kind of an ignorant statement to say, well, computers can calculate pi much higher than mankind. Computers can divide faster than we can, multiply faster than we can, memorize stuff, compute stuff, correlate stuff. But man invented the computer, right? So it's just a tool. Being smarter than man, I think, would be more than passing a Turing test. It'd be more like it wrote the best movie of the year. It wrote the best book of the year, wrote the most meaningful poem of the year. It was able to predict something that really saved humanity. That's where we really can say it exists, right? But Time Magazine published an issue in the early 2000s that predicted by 2045, I think, or 2040, somewhere in there, that man was going to be transformed using transhumanism technology, being nanosystem technology, and that we would never be the same, but that we would be stronger, right? We'd be a bunch of $6 million men. And so what's profound about that article, which I believe was published on February 14th, Valentine's Day, was that it's making a prediction about something that above ground really isn't occurring, unless we take into account printing bodily organs using 3D printers and nanotechnology, right? But the assertion was way beyond those basic kind of replacement organ mechanisms. This is about having a better memory, being more intelligent, and that sort of thing. Well, let's go back to the notion of, and I'm not really trying to connect dots for you. I'm just throwing some other fields of thought out there to you so you can make your own assessments and maybe do some more research and maybe establish a strong link between these things. You know, we know that carbon taxation is geared towards reducing world population. I've talked about this a lot, so I won't repeat myself, but that's where global warming comes from. It's a carbon taxation system to make it too expensive to multiply, too expensive to exist in some cases for the poor. So the rich will be fully apt of having infinite children and having infinite resources, and the poor will be restricted by law if we let it take place and not existing. I know that the elite of the world are very, very concerned about overpopulation. And I have this from a second degree meeting I've talked about several times. And one of them was a Rothschild. So what do you think the odds are that they have this goal in the 2040s to make man pretty much unbelievably, invincibly intelligent, maybe even biologically invincible, thus increasing the longevity of man because any organ that fails, you merely replace it, including organs that are currently unthinkably irreplaceable, like eyeballs and brains and nervous systems. Maybe they can, in the future, replace these things. And so those with money and resources and privilege can live indefinite lives. And those of us who are normal can't. Well, we have this agenda to depopulate. We have the Georgia Guidestones, which talk about killing off 98 to 99% of the entire world. What do you think the odds are that they want the entire world, the 7.5 billion rough people, if that number's correct, to be superhumans? Would the people that run the world really want that much competition, where we're all sort of Star Trek Datas and we're super hyper intelligent, making our own decisions for our own lives, kind of breaking out of the mold of fascism and globalism? I think most of you could conclude that probably isn't the agenda. So if the goal is to get, and I'm just hypothesizing here, I don't think any of these predictions ever come true, right? I mean, Walt Disney thought that by 1987, you know, we would have self-driving cars and, you know, zero gravity systems and all that kind of stuff, because that's where science was at the moment he made the prediction, that's where it was headed. And it miraculously disappeared, right? Anti-gravity research in universities disappeared. About 65. But you have this notion that we see a lot of things going on with bad foods, GMO foods, right? It makes you metabolize several forms of cancer. Who knows how far the agenda goes with the glyphosate in our systems, the terminated gene sequences in GMO food. There's this huge push to be vegetarian because that makes you eat the most GMO product that they have available, which is vegetables and fruits. So if you consume a ton of that stuff based on a religious belief that the way the earth was actually manufactured, either by God or by sheer science, you shouldn't kill things with eyeballs, as if plants don't have life just as rich as animals, then perhaps the depopulation is really sort of on autopilot, right? If you're prone to be weak-minded and grab agendas, such as vegetarianism, denying your body the proteins and amino acids that red meat gives your body to recreate itself, right? Eventually you'll get sick, right? You'll get extremely wrinkly, thin skin, which is always the characteristic of vegetarians. You look way older than you really should look. Then it's a matter of intelligence. Depopulation will have folks that minimize all the things that make you sick. They say cell phones don't cause any problems, fluoride's good for you, artificial sugars are good for you, GMO foods are good for you, etc. down the line. So then by sheer intelligence, or lack thereof, you eliminate yourself, you eliminate your children. We know that obesity is a big problem in the world right now. America just losing its first place to Mexico for obesity. Europe is right behind us. And so people are getting diabetic. The B negative, which I guess is the most prone to diabetes, is off the chain in terms of its proliferation through mankind, which is a copper deficiency in blood. Almost every human being is horribly deficient in vitamin D because no one goes outside anymore because all their friends are on their phone. Living in Southern California, I will tell you that I've never seen a community of more healthy, happy people on planet Earth than California. And I haven't traveled around the world. But, when I went to England several times, it was as if you were a 27-year-old female, you were already 30 pounds overweight. And my friends over there talk about it all the time and how they said that, 30 years ago, England was very healthy. And it was only the older people that sort of, got comfortable and sitting in their lounge chairs. They got heavy. Everyone else was okay. So we see a natural process going on to depopulate the world. But perhaps if this Morgellon thing is real, and again, I don't mean to add to anyone's psychosis about this, but perhaps it's there to augment toxification through this piezo effect where they insert a frequency on you and it creates disruptive materials in your body. But maybe it's just to control your mind. Who knows, right? Maybe it doesn't affect your biology at all. Now, the woman who coined the connection between Morgellon's disease and her husband's death and her own suffering, if you look at the photographs of this, again, I'll try to put the other link in there too, which is an ABC interview with the family that I guess was the first people to outwardly, overtly suffer from this, including a husband who was a former athlete, a very stout man who looked like he could conquer anything and would never get sick, died of this stuff, a very emaciated human being. They blamed it on ALS. I lost a really good friend from high school last year due to ALS, and he was very skeptical the entire time. We talked all the time. I almost can't believe he's gone. It's crazy because 2 years ago, we were having all kinds of conversations, probably had conversations about 5 years about it. But, 2 years ago, he said, look, man, this stuff's killing me. It's going up to my heart and it's going to kill me. And sure enough, that's exactly what it did. And, there's no lesions on his body or anything like that. But we have to be careful with medical diagnoses that attach illnesses, especially bizarre ones, to sort of shadowy conditions, right? If the ailment like autism, which is sort of anytime there's a mental defect in a child, it's always blamed on autism. The idea that the conditions of autism are, they have similarities in categorizations, but the fact that some kids can be diagnosed after they get their shots, they go nuts, have a seizure, they lose the ability to speak, to communicate, to operate properly, and then, 5 years later, 10 years later, they're fine. It really shows that they ingested a toxin, had it root around their brain and hurt them, and eventually their brain repaired enough that they could regain, communication with society, right? If you guys haven't seen my episode on Big Pharma, please go take a look at that in season one. I had a very, very in-depth encounter with that industry. Being an engineer, I got to see sort of the lack of moral fiber in the group that I work with, but I also got to see a lot of data from competing companies, because the piece of software I developed in my early 20s was to help my company beat other companies getting through clinical studies faster, and that just spells disaster and death and side effects and all kinds of bad stuff. But I was too young to know. I wasn't awake at all, right? So I'm sort of was participating in something that I didn't realize I was participating in. But there are, you know, just to remind you, there are no moral fibers in corporations, right? You wouldn't trust McDonald's to feed you food that's going to make you healthy. And you shouldn't trust any pharmaceutical company on earth, including oncology departments and cancer centers, to do anything to help you out. It's whatever the business model will facilitate profit is what they'll do. They'll do the bare minimum to take your money and not be sued by you, right? Chemotherapy, which some people swear by because it did help them, is ancient. It's 28 years old, and it hasn't been upgraded in any way, shape, or form that I'm aware of since 1989, when the last patent refinement was filed. That's my knowledge of it. It could be something recently happened to it, but you know, it's just a barbaric way of filling your body with radioactive isotopes to kill everything in your body and hopefully the cancer. But over, 97% of people who take chemotherapy die of the chemotherapy. And we consider this progress. We consider this a valid form of treating cancer. Again, if you're in the surviving group, you'll swear by it. But if you're in the group that the 3% that, or the 97%, excuse me, that died of it, you're not going to feel so, you know, cheery about it, right? Again, if Morgellons disease was as prominent as it looks like on the internet, I think that every single one of us, like cancer, we would know someone who has it and whose body is rejecting it. But the final note I want to make on this is sort of the final note that Dr. Smallstorm talked about, which is this. Those who get, I mentioned something as a side note to this. Those of you who get, those of you who have bad complexions, your face seems to exude pimples a lot. You maybe have cystic pimples, maybe you're just the normal whitehead pimples. What's interesting about your system, as I'm sure it frustrates you to death, is that, you know, most of the time we get those in our teens because our hormones are showing up for life, and some of you go work in fast food. But what's happening is there are toxins in your body that your body knows is something that shouldn't be there. These particular toxins exude out of your face because, one, your pores in your face are massive, right? And some of you get them on your back and various other parts of your body. What you're looking at there is the fact that your epidermis is designed to exude toxins, right? Something I always forget to mention on the show is that over 10, 12 years now, I haven't used aluminum-based deodorants. Now, the alternative is I use just a deodorant. Now, I'm blessed with the fact I don't sweat much at all. If I'm sweating, man, it is hot and it is humid. But I don't sweat that much even when that occurs. So I don't need a lot to conceal my natural odor. After 2 days, I definitely have a natural odor. But your armpits are designed to push all this out. Unfortunately, our crotches are typically a place where we're also sweating. Part of it's because of the way it's all folded up in there, but the other part is just, it's just a way, it's a path of least resistance for your body to push out a toxin. And unfortunately, our face is designed to do this as well. So the reason why we get a lot of pimples on our face is because that's the exit point. It's just the path of least resistance. I don't know if it has anything to do with having eaten the food through our mouths, breathed it through our nose, and therefore, it's also the shortest distance, right? But the last part of the concern is that perhaps, again, forget the wine test, okay? Perhaps, you know, some of our bodies, they accept this invader from wherever it's coming from. And perhaps we are growing these devices in our bodies, and our bodies are, the bodies believe it's a friendly. The immune system doesn't identify it as an invader. Now, I find that almost impossible to believe. I've seen the impossible happen on my entire life. I never quite go 100% on impossible, but, you know, I think that if our bodies were growing crystalline structures, hexagonal crystals in our body, there wouldn't be any way for the immune system to go, oh, yeah, this should be here. I also don't think that it would be possible for us to be full of fibers without us noticing them, feeling them, and that kind of stuff. So perhaps if this does exist, right, and I have no evidence that it exists personally, just so you know, I'm coming at you just regurgitating the information, hopefully in a useful way. I wouldn't know why some bodies, meaning people's human flesh, manifest this Morgellons, and it would seem that most of us don't, right? I mean, I just can't imagine. I've got friends of mine that have the most sensitive skin on planet Earth, and when you give them a hand massage or a shoulder massage, they just melt, right? I think most of us do, but what are the odds that we have this amazing sensitivity to our bodies, but we wouldn't have the sensitivity to feel something manifesting and multiplying underneath our skin? It seems, again, virtually impossible to believe such a thing. And what would be the idea that these would manifest into anything other than the nano programming of the structures to turn into the devices? Like, would it turn into something else in our bodies? That's also very hard to believe. Nanosystems are very primitive systems that do what they do. They don't have, as far as I know, a bunch of logic gates in to say, okay, in this particular human, you know, make weird blood cells that do something strange in the body. So my exiting caution is definitely be careful hearing about Morgellons and then thinking you have it, right? You're going to want to have some massive evidence to have that conclude in your mind that you do have it, right? The thing I've seen on the internet several times, it's been said by all kinds of people and close, and that one friend of mine who thinks he has it, they've all said the same thing. And they say, well, the second I read about it is the second I knew I had it. Doesn't mean they don't, but that's the way psychosomatic things occur, right? Now, the family that has, that coined the phrase, the mother coined, you know, made the connection, she is not really in that category because she was investigating something that had no name. She lost her husband, and she has photographs of her husband covered in this horrible rash, which was never addressed. So he had supposedly ALS and died of ALS, but he had a condition that I do not believe is a byproduct of ALS in any way, shape, or form. My buddy never talked about his skin turning red. And my buddy did not die emaciated by any means. He was probably a little husky by the time it was over. So I'm not a doctor in these areas whatsoever. So I just can observe and comment, right? So the other thing I want to remind you at the end is that disinformation and fear is a way that the world is being ruled. And I know most of you realize this. None of us want that to be the case, but it happens, right? I was looking at the news the other day, going through the top websites of the world that you all visit, and I was just observing it from a different standpoint than I ever had before, very specifically, and that is how over-the-top, outrageous, and fear-mongering. We always talk about the fear element, but I'm not sure we talk about the more metaphysical feelings that it gives us, but it never gives us really a sense of security. It never gives us any solace. It's always there to take things that would perhaps make us feel better and make us feel horrible. You know, we've had an election here in the United States of America, and some people are very happy about the candidate that was selected. Obviously, there's a good portion of people that aren't. It's not a big leap to say, well, the people that are angry are still angry and fearful and what have you, right? But even for the folks that have their candidate in office soon, 2 days as a result from this day, you know, this recording, this is January 18th, they are not allowed to be happy about the about what happened, about the results, because all of the organizations that are supposedly on the side of that candidate are releasing article after article daily, probably four times a day, taking it and making it tumultuous and acidic to the mind and acidic to the soul. I mean, if you really, really cared about any politics in any country around the world, you're encouraged to get an ulcer if you research it through mainstream media, which is why most of us are rejecting mainstream media. So it's important when we have YouTube largely being the only place that this information can be gathered, that we take everything with a huge grain of salt. Again, if you haven't seen something with your own eyes, you should be probably skeptical until you do. And that could be as simple as, you know, the folks that believe in the disc flat earth saying, well, I haven't seen earth from space, so I can't assume that that's the shape it is. You know, all right. As much as you may disagree with that, you still can respect their position. I don't want this episode to be responsible for someone being hysterical. I don't want this episode to be responsible for someone self-diagnosing with Morgellons disease without a lot of empirical data, physical data, coming out of your body, right? The dismissive doctors have a point that we have to check out first and prove them wrong before we go off immediately jumping off into something that is potentially terrifying for the mind, which is to say, yeah, you could scratch yourself for the reason of a bug bite, anything. You're scratching a wart, you're scratching something that you didn't notice you already had, and you open up a sore in your skin, and then you are scratching through the material of your shirts. And some of you live in like very wet, cold areas of the world, so you're never not wearing a sweater, something with very open fiber systems, right? If you wear a nice shirt, then those fibers aren't likely to come off in any lesion that you might have created through scratching. But if you are in a colder climate, and you're scratching, and if this stuff happens to show up more in winter than summer, then you want to check it against that assertion, because I think it's a fair diagnosis that some people probably just have pushed fibers into their body through scratching. Once you get past that, if you've got more data, if again these fibers are crawling out of your body while you're watching, then you probably have something that you need to look deeper into, right? I've never seen this personally, so. I think that's it. Hopefully I've covered this in a way that kind of opens up your mind, connects a few dots, allows you to research other dots that might be connected. Hope this was entertaining. If you dig the episode, please like it. If you like the whole series, please subscribe. I'm going to continue repeating that this is a variety show. So I got a lot of interest when I did the two moon episodes. The subscriptions seem to be slowly climbing, and then you know, I've got these other episodes that are more about conditions of the mind, and I almost worry about, you know, gaining a bunch of viewers through a scientific episode burst and then losing them the second that we come up with the more cerebral stuff. And it's not that my goal is to get a bunch of subscribers, but the idea is just hang in there. If you don't like an episode, just don't watch it. Don't worry about it. There'll be more. Just relax, give me a couple of weeks, and I will throw another one out in the category that you like. I have quite a few cerebral ones in the queue, but what I'm doing is I'm strategically creating more scientific ones and checking the release. So hopefully that works for you. Again, if you've made it this far, you deserve a trophy. Take care of yourself and someone else, and I will see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over and out.